This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply that proves that award season is a year-round event. I'm Katie Richter, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, back here in the New York office and in studio with our film critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello, we're not letting you leave.
Our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Please stay.
And on the line is our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hello.
And we're joined right now by a special guest, Johanna Desta, our staff writer. Hi, you can say hi.
Hello.
Yeah, I was like, what do I say?
So as we talked about last week, Emmy season is in full swing, and on VF.com we're running a series of conversations with people who made some of the most interesting television of the last year. And Johanna, we brought you in to kind of kick off today's or this week's version of that because you talked to Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who is the showrunner and star and writer and director of
every hat possible that you could wear on Fleabag. She wears them all.
So tell us about what fascinated you about this character who is just called Fleabag, and why she felt like a character you wanted to bring back up in this for your consideration period.
I was one of those people who heard about the show super late in the game. Like, everyone had already seen it and said it was the best thing ever, and then I watched it and it was like getting punched in the gut. It's so good. It's like this perfect mix between like a comedy and a drama, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge is like the mastermind of the whole thing. She's such a great performer. When I found out she's like the writer and the creator and the showrunner, I was like, you are an incredible tour de force, and I need to talk to you and know everything about this show.
So where did she come from? I feel like we always hear about these British talents who like become famous here and they've been famous for a decade, like James Corden. But is she like one of those, or is she kind of an out of nowhere success?
I don't know too much about like her entire like theatrical background, but she started in theater, I'm pretty sure. She also had like another show, I think it was called Crashing, and then Fleabag was born of like a monologue that she wrote and used to perform, I think in England. And then someone was like, this would be a great show. And she was like, yeah, I agree. I'm going to write a couple episodes.
Yeah, it's my British addiction. Her show Crashing is on Netflix. So if you watched Fleabag and you're like, it's not enough, I need more. It's really good. And it's not as good as Fleabag, but you can see sort of the seeds of Fleabag there and her being sort of unapologetically not the nicest person, but still someone that you're rooting for. And I think she hasn't been like super, she wasn't super famous. It's not like a James Corden who was famous in England for a long time before he came over here. Right. But yeah, as Johanna said, I think she did like a lot of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and stuff like that before hitting it big. And now she's in Star Wars and doing a million other things. So
yeah, she's kind of like Sharon Horgan or something, you know, who created it.
Yes.
Catastrophe, you know, who had another show that was popular, but this second one that's also on Amazon, like Fleabag is, was the one that kind of got her more international notice. And Fleabag is on Amazon, so you can watch Crashing on Netflix and then go to the competition and you're having a full streaming day.
Yeah. That way. Yeah. So what did you learn in talking to Phoebe, Johanna?
I learned a lot about like things that she cut, like the things that were in the original play that she didn't want to include that went like way too dark. Oh God, like it's so like straight up like perverse stuff for people who haven't seen the show.
You can swear on this podcast.
Yeah, okay. It's like, it's a very dirty show. It's very raunchy. It's about sex, and I guess in like a tasteful like way, but it's still like pretty straight up. So there were a lot of scenes that were cut that were just super sexual, where Amazon was like, you can do everything, but hey, maybe let's cut that thing out, like this crazy imagination scene that she has about a doctor who's giving her a mammogram, and it just goes a little bit further from there. And they're like,
even streaming companies have a limit. You yeah. can't do with anything you want on Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah. But she's such a delight. She's really funny. She like loves talking about the character. And I learned a lot too about like things that she included that she didn't even realize people would pick up on. Like the fact that the character doesn't have a name. She didn't really think very deeply about that. The character is just Fleabag. And then after the show came out, she was like, oh yeah, it's like this kind of cool way to make her even messier, to make her more mysterious to the viewer. 'Cause like, even though you're privy to like her breaking the fourth wall and talking to you, she still has this bit of mystery in this way.
So the whole idea of us writing these Emmy season articles is kind of make the case for these people to get Emmy nominations. Do we feel like she has a chance in this very crowded Emmy field?
Oh, man. I feel like most of the competition is over in like limited series and stuff. Is Fleabag going to be considered that, or is she?
I think it's a regular series. Yeah.
But it's a comedy, even though it's very dark, right?
Yeah. It's a comedy. It's half hour, you know?
Yeah. I mean, all the comedies are dark these days.
Yeah. What do you think, Jordan?
I feel like she has a shot to get in where exactly what Richard said, where Sharon Horgan got in last year, which was in the writing category. Mm-hmm. That I believe Catastrophe got a writing nomination. So I could definitely see her getting, like, you know, I think that the awards seasons are really tending towards rewarding these Renaissance men and women, right? So Aziz Ansari and Donald Glover, and so hopefully Phoebe Waller-Bridge and Issa Rae and like these other people who are wearing all the hats. Mm-hmm. And the various academies are like, we see you wearing all those hats here. Have a trophy to hang your hat on now.
But it also seems like that's kind of unfair advantage in a writing category if you're also the star and on screen. Like, it just, you're just more famous than all the other writers that no one's ever heard of.
Yeah, you're a little more high profile and people are like, oh yeah, that one. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I recognize that face.
Yeah.
It reminds me of like the year, I don't know, there was some year that Mad Men was nominated, I think, in like four of the five categories, and it was like it was the staff, but every single category was like Matthew Weiner,
right.
Like, who's gonna win if they're nominated in four out of the five categories? But you're right, Mike, if they're like celebrity writers,
it's a way to stand out in a list of names that might be not that familiar.
And it's nice to see a woman take the stage for one of those writing categories and not just the acting category. So that's an advantage there too.
Mm-hmm. Now, so the show, like you mentioned, Johanna, is pretty, it goes there, as they used to say about Degrassi. So, and some of the, you know, the Emmys, the voters tend to be, you know, they nominate kind of out there stuff sometimes, but you know, as with anything, any other voting body, there's, you know, you kind of, there's a reason Frasier won like 18 years in a row and why Monk won 18 years in a row. You know, how would you pitch Fleabag to like someone older who was very resistant to the idea of the show? Like, how would you bring someone into it?
I mean, I think I would play up that it feels very theatrical. Like, it's very much like a character study in a way, even though it's about, you know, her really messed up relationship with sex. It's also about her relationship with her family. She has a really strange relationship with her dad, and she has a really strange relationship with her sister. So they are, even though it can get very sexual at times, it really is this fascinating portrait of a woman who's kind of in shambles and how she uses sex to sort of grasp at things and just to sort of like grasp at things and challenge herself, and then it ends up ruining her life in a lot of different ways. So it's interesting how she uses it as a device rather than just like, here's a sexy scene of me like doing stuff.
Right. It has a kind of psychological honesty to it, because she's also grieving for a friend, right? So yeah, I think that's good. I mean, you know, people like complicated comedy these days, it feels like.
Well, you know, that was interesting. That was one of the things she talked about too, was like, she didn't want sex to be like the thing that traumatized the character only, which is why she had like personal loss being like the main thing that really messed up this character. You know, it's about her best friend dying, and it's about her mom dying a long time ago and how that impacts her life now. So there are other elements to it as well.
And it is funny.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound funny, but it is.
Oh man, the modern comedy. It's just sad.
So, Johanna, your Phoebe Waller-Bridge interview is up on the site now. I think you're doing some other Emmy for your consideration interviews, right? So that we can see more where that came from.
Yeah. There are some people I'm like brainstorming that I want to talk to, but I haven't talked to them yet. And I talked to some other folks who I just find interesting, even though they're not really in the conversation, like John Early, who's on Search Party and is so good.
We can put him in the conversation. That's what this is all about. That's
John Early. Right. Remember John Early? Yeah, he's so good. And yeah, there's some other people I'm hoping to talk to, but
cool.
I'm not talking
well,
to them
people should go read your article up right now.
And, including especially Emmy voters.
Yeah. That's all of the Emmy voters listening, please go vote for Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Okay, so in our continuing Emmys FYC season, we also have an article from Joanna that I think has gone up this week about Carrie Coon, who is not just amazing on The Leftovers, but is amazing on a whole different series. She's just like everywhere.
I talked to Damon Lindelof and Noah Hawley, who are two critically beloved showrunners, who both chose Carrie Coon to be their leading ladies this season, The Leftovers for its third and final season, and The Fargo for its sort of third installment. And what's really uncanny, having watched all the way through both series, I watched to the end of Fargo, even though it still has a couple more episodes to air, is how both these men sort of independently of each other wrote very similar stories for Carrie Coon, down to the fact that, like, her character technology doesn't work around her character, like all these weird specific things that they wrote independently. And like, Damon got really mad because he asked Carrie Coon, he's like, did you leak all of this to Noah? And she's like, no. And then Noah got really mad because Carrie didn't tell him that he was essentially writing like the same thing that The Leftovers had done. So,
guys, work this out for yourselves. This isn't Carrie's fault.
She was so funny because I talked to her about it. She was like, I was just keeping quiet and sort of just seeing what was going to happen. but that's very her. She's very like, she was raised in the Midwest. She's very, you know, Carrie Coon has a background in theater. She's married to Pulitzer Prize winning playwright Tracy Letts. She's very intellectual. But, you know, I sort of was curious what it was about Carrie as a person that had inspired these two, I consider, television geniuses to write basically the same story for her. And I think it's just a brightness. You know, Mike and I disagreed about The Leftovers season one. Mike was a huge champion of it, and I really didn't like it. But what I could concede is that Carrie was a really bright spot in a very dark and depressing first season. And Lindelof actually gives her credit for finding lightness and humor and basically changing the tone entirely of The Leftovers and making it into the critically beloved, if criminally underwatched, show that it became. So, yeah, so it's just, there's something different about Carrie. Like, I've talked to her a number of times now, and she's so smart, but she doesn't take herself too seriously. She works really hard. She's a very bright and optimistic person. And so they just, like, both of them, I think, wanted this brightness from her. And The Leftovers, which started, you know, it started kind of at the tail end of the quote unquote golden age of television, of the male antihero golden age of television. And so it started with Justin Theroux sort of in that male antihero role. And then they were like, yeah, you know what? Who's more interesting is Carrie Coon. So the show ends as more of a two-hander, actually even weighted actually more towards her at the end, The Leftovers. So, and then I guess the last thing I'll say is that this is the epitome of Carrie Coon, I think, is I asked her, I was like, what's it like sort of being under consideration for these two big, sort of, they're not hugely popular shows, but they're critically beloved shows. And she's like, oh, I have no expectation. She's like, here's what history tells me. I've never been nominated before. I don't think I'm going to get nominated now. I told my mom it's not happening. So, Emmy voters, if you're listening, prove her
wrong.
Fix
that.
Please.
I mean, I think there's something else about her kind of recent success is that when she was in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which was a Steppenwolf production that transferred to Broadway, she was one of three of the four actors to get nominated for a Tony. She had not really worked in television or film at all before, and this was only a few years ago. And so it's not like we haven't seen a ton of Carrie Coon, you know, in her 20s, and, you know, she's kind of brand new, and but is so capable. So it's really exciting to see this, to kind of like figure this person out, like in these kind of high profile setting, because people want to work with her. So she's just exciting because it's like, where the hell did she come from?
Yeah.
She came from Chicago.
Yeah. Most good things. But we feel like if she gets nominated, it's probably for The Leftovers.
Yeah, she was such, I mean, the Fargo has really, I actually struggled with Fargo for a while this season, even though it's been historically one of my favorite shows, and it really only clicked into place what they were trying to do about three quarters of the way through. Like with The Leftovers, I think we all got kind of distracted by the Ewan McGregor of it all, and that wasn't really the point. It's the Carrie Coon and Mary Elizabeth Winstead of it all, and that's sort of what they're figuring out in the back quarter, I think. So, and the David Thewlis, who's having a moment of it all.
Oh man, I just saw Wonder Woman. He really is having a moment.
So, I don't think Fargo is going to be much of a presence at all. Like, maybe a nomination for Ewan because of his star quality, but like, I think Fargo is going
just made
be.
Such a face.
Well, isn't Ewan the reason that Fargo season 3 isn't good? I mean, the two were better because he wasn't in them. Sorry.
Has that stopped, like, you know, nominating bodies before? I don't know.
I like Ewan McGregor a lot. But I like he was so miscast too. In that role, and I just couldn't watch the season.
He gets better toward the end, but I don't know if would Emmy voters aren't going to watch till the very end. They're going to watch the one episode or whatever that's submitted, and, you know.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, like, I think you're right, Joanne. I think Leftovers, which, you know, just because it had all this critical fanfare, Lindelof is a celebrity in his own right.
Yeah.
That people are going to pay more attention to that. And, you know, if they submit the right episode, which I think would be the finale for Carrie Coon, where she has this 7-8 minute long monologue at the very end, there you go. That, I mean, I would hope that would be it.
Yeah.
That finale also is part of the larger TV narrative of this great, like, TV finale redemption for Damon Lindelof, because it's pretty much unanimously seen as a very successful sticking of the landing for The Leftovers after... When I interviewed Carrie Coon the day after The Leftovers finale aired, and she was, her first thing she said is like, isn't this great news for Damon? I'm so happy for him. He can let it go. He can let all the lost stuff go now. And I was like,
oh, that's his lost vindication. Okay.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about the way it ended is that it did the same, and I mean, spoiler alert, but it did the same thing it lost did, that, which is forget all the mystery and the supernatural, blah, blah, blah. If this was always about the humanity and the heart of it all, and when that's what Lost did, it infuriated me. I was like, "Are you kidding me? I've devoted 6 years to this thing, 22 episodes a season." But with Leftovers, it totally works. It's the same exact kind of cop out in a way, but it totally buy it.
Which is interesting because that's really the difference of how you did the whole rest of the show. Like that ending is only going to work when you weren't hanging into the show waiting for solutions to ridiculous
mysteries. And when you say, you know, up front, and I think they said Lindelof said in the first season, we are never going to tell you what happened, where these people, you know, what it was, what caused it.
And they weren't constantly picking that stat.
They weren't teasing things to Jeff Jensen at Entertainment Weekly every week.
When the theme song for your second season is Let the Mystery Be, like, that you're like laying track for this. And what they did really successfully in the finale, once again, no like explicit spoilers, but whereas The Leftovers made a lot of that supernatural stuff kind of visually part of the finale, this left some questions of perhaps supernatural or otherworldly, whatever, in the imagination of the viewer and kept everything very grounded in reality. And I think they just made a million tiny decisions that resulted in just a much better wrap up with, you're totally right, Richard, a very similar philosophy behind it. So,
And she's, and Coon is very much at the center of that. And she like holds that final episode beautifully. And
it's just so good.
Yeah.
Like, I know we've talked a lot about the technical awards that are open because Game of Thrones is not in the running this year. The wig work and makeup work on the finale of The Leftovers is so good. It's amazing. So that's what would have my vote for makeup and wig.
Subtlety is key. And then and that's what they did. And she really does look maybe, you know, however many years older.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOC.
Can you tell us what AWOC means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOC.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's greatest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segeith, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists. Binge all episodes of Blame It on the Fame, Milli Vanilli, ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
So it is still summer movie season. There is good stuff coming out that isn't Transformers The Last Night, which, Richard, you'll be suffering through at some point soon.
I think you guys are,
it's 3 hours long.
Michael Bay corrected that. It's not apparently, but it's still over 2 hours.
it's just somehow still too long. But anyway, coming out next week is The Big Sick, which you may remember when Richard was at Sundance, who was talking about it as one of the big hits out of there. Mm-hmm. And Richard, you talked to Michael Showalter, who is the director of the movie, a little while ago. We're going to share that interview, but I just wanted to hear a little bit about The Big Sick. I mean, it's coming out next week. It's a summer movie. It's a rom-com, which has a happy ending that everyone knows about because it's about a woman in a coma based on the woman who co-wrote the screenplay.
Right, right.
But it seems to have a lot of prestige around. It's got buzz in a way that a lot of summer movies don't.
Yeah, it was a movie that I skipped at Sundance because I was hungry, and of course it was the movie that everyone loved. Luckily, Jordan Hoffman, our stringer, was able to see it and review it that day. But I caught it later. And yeah, it's produced by Judd Apatow, and it has his stamp all over it. It's long. It's a lot about comedy and comedians and kind of a lot of improvised seeming banter. Bo Burnham is in there, A.D. Bryant from SNL. But it also has this emotional component. It's very much about family. It's very sort of like, in some ways, centered on sort of the relationships and family being the sort of core of a person's life, you know, which is a very sort of Apatowian ideal. That said, it has this other perspective because Kumail Nanjiani co-wrote it and is the star. And, you know, aren't you sick of all of these splashy romantic comedies with a Pakistani American as a lead?
I know.
It's just like another one about a Muslim family, just so
all
many
these pop culture depictions of Muslims as positive role models.
So that's a really exciting element to it, but you know, in no way does the movie sort of rely on that to just sort of skate by. It's a nicely textured, thoughtful movie with beautiful, I mean, Nanjiani's great in it, Zoe Kazan is really good as the girlfriend in a coma. But most excitingly, beyond Kumail being in the movie, is that playing Zoe Kazan's character's parents are Ray Romano and Holly Hunter, which is kind of crazy out-of-the-box casting, especially for Ray Romano, but they're both great. And they're just, Nanjiani has most of his scenes with them, not with Zoe Kazan. And their dynamic is really interesting, and it's just like a funny one we haven't really seen, or I haven't seen in for a while on screen, where a guy's relationship with his girlfriend's parents sort of takes center stage, mm-hmm. So it's fun. It's a crowd pleaser for sure. And I think it's coming out in a kind of dire time for movies like this season, mm-hmm. So I think it's great counter programming.
I mean, so I saw some of the usual suspects who we know and love squabbling with each other on Twitter about whether or not considering Ray Romano and Holly Hunter as like Oscar long shots was ridiculous. It seems worth trying. If they're as good as everyone says they are, like someone should put like a couple bucks behind an FYC campaign for them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it came out a little bit later in the year, but was similarly at Sundance and similarly toned in a way. Other people, the Chris Kelly movie, Molly Shannon kind of rode that supporting buzz to an Indie Spirit Award. Exactly. She didn't get an Oscar nomination, as some thought, maybe when we saw it back in Sundance. But I think absolutely. I think that movie will have, it definitely has its ardent fans already. So I think that what just remains to be seen is whether it connects with mainstream audiences and is a box office hit, or if it goes the way of Me and Earl and the Dying Girl or something, which I don't think it will. I think this one's a little more accessible.
Yeah, I mean, I actually, my perspective on this now, I live in a town that has one indie theater that has very good movies that come through, but it's like, one or two at a time. And the movies lately, it's been like Norman, the movie with Richard Gere, and a lot of kind of like very adult movies. Mm-hmm. And I feel like something comes through like The Big Sick, and I think it's opening in some limited release. It may go wide at some point, but it's an indie. And so when you get something like that comes in there, you're like, oh, this is charming and has young people, and like it seems like something that can really draw people in that way, especially in the summer.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it has shades of Mike Birbiglia's movie Don't Think Twice, mm-hmm. which was this kind of sleeper hit. It ran for ages in indie theaters in New York, and at least that had the sort of added effect that Ira Glass was shilling it every week on This American Life, who is a producer in the movie. But yeah, I don't know. It's. I think people will be. It'll be welcome relief for those who are sick of things blowing up and whatnot.
Yeah.
Counter programming. And if you've heard any single interview with Kumail and Emily, like they're just so charming, and they are very aware that they are the counter programming of the summer, and that's sort of what they've been trying to sell themselves as in interviews. And I really do. I agree. I really do see this. It's not going to be train wreck. you know, it's not going to be that Judd Apatow comedy of the summer, but it, I really do think that it has like legs and potential. So, I'm excited.
And Joanna, you're a fan of Kumail from way back. So I'm it's kind huge, of like seeing a local boy made good.
That's what it feels like. And Emily too. Like I've heard them on podcasts for, you know, because this is a story that they used to occasionally tell about like her going into a coma and, you know, and so I heard that story like, I don't know, like 7 years ago now, I think something like that, or 5 years ago. And, so to see it made into this movie that's not only, you know, has all these other great names in it, but everyone really likes it. Like that's just, yeah, it does. It feels like a friend, even though he's definitely not my friend. So,
you know. He's friend to us all.
Sure.
So Richard, you talked to Michael Showalter, who's the director, who has his own fascinating background in comedy.
He's
a veteran of the state. He was one of the guys involved in Wet Hot American Summer. He has directed some movies before, but I don't think anything he's directed has had quite the buzz or impact around it that this has. It's kind of an interesting step up for him.
It is. Yeah. And we talked while he was out for a walk, and he, you know, he just had kind of a lot to say about kind of this second phase of his career. I guess we could look at it in a way, or third phase or something, because, you know, this is a more mainstream movie, right? He did last year or 2 years ago, Hello, My Name is Doris with Sally Field, which was good. It was great, but like had a kind of darkness to it that Big Sick doesn't quite. But yeah, I asked him about that, and he really talked about how he loves romantic comedies, always has. And though he's parodied them in the past with something like They Came Together, this, you know, he was like, I just kind of applied that same love just more sincerely. So I think it pays off. And, you know, we also talked about his show Search Party, which is decidedly darker. He created it with two younger writers who he taught at NYU, actually. And is sort of mentoring them through the process. And so, yeah, so he's kind of doing a lot of interesting things behind the camera right now, which is bearing fruit. So that's kind of mostly what we spoke about.
Yeah. So let's listen to your interview with Michael Showalter.
I'm on the line now with Michael Showalter, the director of The Big Sick, which was really one of the biggest breakout hits of Sundance this year. And Michael is kind of moving into a new phase of his career as a director. So Michael, congrats on that. That must have been quite a premiere. Because I mean, I remember when that screened, it was just people just exploded when the movie got out. So what can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
You know, it's always a very sort of emotional and nervous moment when you show your movie to a big audience for the first time. And it's kind of an out-of-body experience, too, because you're seeing it differently than when you're with your collaborators in an editing room. You're seeing different places where the audience laughs or doesn't laugh, or you're maybe scanning their faces and stuff. And quite honestly, I wasn't sure how it was playing when it was screening. I couldn't tell. And I've since realized that part of that might be, and this is not a joke, because I was feeling the altitude. The altitude was having a real effect on me. And so I think I might have been like a little bit out of it during the screening.
Yeah, I mean, that happens there for sure. I've fallen prey to it myself.
Yes, on the one hand, your movie is screening at Sundance, and on the other hand, you have very poor circulation in your feet.
Right. But yeah, I mean, after the screening, I mean, you know, when reviews started coming in and tweets and all that, it seemed clear that this was going to be one of the big hits of the festival this year, which, you know, it's proven to be. Was there anything about this reaction that surprised you? Did people, I guess, kind of interact with the movie in a way that was unexpected? Or was it kind of, you were like, okay, right, you know, they got what I was trying to do exactly.
I mean, you know, have you seen the film?
I have, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The sort of needle that we were always trying to thread with the movie was how to keep the first act of the movie is kind of a straightforward romantic comedy love story. And then half an hour into the movie, I don't think I'm spoiling anything by saying this, but Emily, Zoe Kazan's character, goes into a coma. And for the next hour of the movie, she's in the hospital in a coma, which is challenging both in terms of ways in which it sort of subverts our expectations of how a story like that is supposed to go. And then also just that it's hard to make a comedy when something as serious as that is going on. And that's not to mention all of the other kind of big challenges we had in terms of the themes we were working with. But that specifically for me was the tightrope of what how this movie was going to work was, were we able to keep the movie feeling like a comedy in the second act while not shortchanging how serious the situation is that these characters are dealing with. And so I think it was gratifying to see that it seemed like we had succeeded at threading that particular needle.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it definitely has this a sort of, you know, a poignancy to it that you wouldn't necessarily associate with a straightforward romantic comedy, but also a humor that you wouldn't associate necessarily with a kind of drama about medical, you know, scares and stuff like that. So it's a good in between. Yeah. You wrote They Came Together, which is this kind of send up of romantic comedy tropes. So I was curious what it was like going from writing that to directing this thing that isn't a parody of, it actually is kind of the real thing. Was that a funny kind of shifting of your perspective, or how did that work for you?
Well, and I also wrote and directed a movie in 2005 called The Baxter, which is a total deconstruction of romantic comedies. And The Baxter is a little bit more sincere than They Came Together. They Came Together is truly, you know, was really just almost a pure spoof.
Yeah.
And in all of the cases, where I think there's crossover and is that in every version of it, I love this genre. And so it's always coming from a place of love. It's never, I'm not making fun of these movies because I think they're stupid. The parodies are really almost love letters to this genre, which I grew up on these movies and have committed them to memory, whether it's, you know, Woody Allen's romantic comedies or Richard Curtis's movies or Nora Ephron. And there's so many great iconic romantic comedies that I have in my sort of my mental encyclopedia that they all kind of blend together. But it is interesting when in a movie like Big Sick, you come across a kind of a convention of a genre, only you're not subverting it, you're actually using it in a sincere way, that you do sort of make a mental note of those moments.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and I'm also curious in terms of this particular material, you know, this is Kumail Nanjiani and Emily Gordon's, you know, story. This is based on their life to an extent. When you're reading a script like that and thinking about directing it, how much are you trying to just be in service of their story, and how much of your stamp do you want to put on it? Is that kind of a conversation you have internally when you're starting out a project like this?
Yeah, I mean, primarily I'm thinking, how can I make their story work the best it can possibly work? That's 99% of my agenda is that when I read the script, I felt like, and this is all very technical, this has nothing to do with just how amazed I was by their story and how kind of relevant I thought it was as a story that needed to be told. And at the time that we started working on this movie, and Kumail and Emily and Judd Apatow were working on it long before I was a part of it, the world was a very different place. And even then, it felt like a very important story to tell. A story about Pakistani-born American citizen who is trying to navigate his life as an American while also trying to cope with his strong identity as a Muslim and a Pakistani. And all of that felt really important to me. And then again, that's sort of what I say, and then add into it, there's this true, incredible true story of how they met, and Emily Gordon's character having had this experience of going into a coma at a very crucial point in their relationship. It's stranger than fiction. When I first read the script, what I felt was, how can I take this story that's true and kind of exploding with ideas and inspiration, and how can I help them frame it in a way and put it in a package that we can then show to other, you know, show to the rest of the world. What I sort of brought to the table, at least initially, was just a lot of ideas that I have kind of in a very dogmatic way about just kind of how to structure a story and how to help structure the story in a way that would be entertaining, as mercenary as that sounds. As the director, a lot of times I was sort of like, I'll be the guy who's just thinking about the result. But as you work on a project like this and you get closer and closer to the material, there's parts of all of us who worked on the movie in the film. It's obviously very much Emily and Kumail's story primarily, but we, you know, there's pieces of me in there as well. And I was in New York City when Kumail moved there at the end of the movie. I won't give anything away, but maybe I already have. Kumail moves to New York and, you know, to pursue his career as a stand-up comedian. And I was in New York. I was one of those comedians that met him when he kind of first got to New York City. And so I feel that connection to the story too, that I remember Kumail from the early days. And I remember being very impressed and intrigued by him.
Oh, wow. So you've had like kind of a long kind of time of being aware of him and now getting to work with him. That's a cool kind of full circle sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, like there's scenes in the movie in the comedy clubs, and like, I was in those clubs. I was there.
Yeah. Yeah.
From a directing standpoint, it was really, that was something that I was excited about, is to try to kind of bring the backstage life of a comedy club onto the screen was something I really wanted to do.
Yeah. And I think you get that. And, you know, I think Bo Burnham and Adi Bryant are great. You know, the whole film is cast really well. The whole cast is great, but I'm especially curious about Holly Hunter and Ray Romano, just because both of them to some extent are playing a little bit against type, or you wouldn't expect to see them in a movie like this. How did they come to be in the film? Was that sort of your stroke of genius, or what was the story there?
You know, we started to kind of conceive of the characters of Emily's parents, which obviously there's a true story there, but then there's also a lot of us just taking some creative license to imagine. And Zoe Kazan, we knew Zoe Kazan was going to play that character and wanting to somewhat cast around her. And then also just, I think early on, we all just started talking about Holly Hunter and Ray as these two actors that we love, that are so special. And we kind of started talking about them in these roles, and then the character sort of started to take shape around that. But they were who we always wanted. It wasn't my stroke of genius. It was, you know, I think Judd Apatow had been talking about Holly Hunter from the very beginning of when I joined the project. And we all know and love her from her early comedies, as well as, you know, everything she's done since. But, you know, Broadcast News and Raising Arizona and this sort of comedic powerhouse that she is. And then Ray Romano is just, we all feel this kind of like, you know, comic genius that we knew could bring the kind of like depth as an actor that the role needed, but also could bring a certain kind of levity and humor to what, as we discussed, was like a very kind of like scary situation in the lives of these characters. And they were both, I mean, it was thrilling to work with them, and they're both like, you know, phenomenal people.
It's I mean, they work out beautifully in the movie. And I think that kind of, you know, Holly Hunter, you know, kind of returning to the sort of comedy of her earlier career. And there's just a lot of kind of career shifting in this movie. You know, Kumail is a leading film, you know, movie star. And, you know, you as a director, I mean, this is not your first film, obviously, but just in the last 2 years between this and Hello, My Name is Doris, you seem to be sort of entering something new. And you mentioned earlier a sincerity. And while Doris is, It's a strange and dark movie, but there's a lot of heart there too. And obviously there's a ton of heart in The Big Sick. Is this kind of a conscious thing that you're creating for yourself, or is it just kind of, as luck would have it, these projects sort of materialized around the same time?
Well, I suppose it's a little bit of both. I mean, it's how I've always, it's sort of who I think I really truly am as a solo on my own. This is my me, you know. Obviously I have done a lot of collaboration with David Wayne and Michael Black, and that's the Wet Hot American Summer and Stella, and They Came Together, which is the more sort of meta, sort of absurdist comedic thing, which is very much me as well. But I think to the extent that it just sort of happened is that I was not really feeling like I was being given the opportunity to show this part of me. I wanted to, and I've wanted to kind of show this part of me and maybe didn't have the opportunity or didn't have the right material to do it. Hello, My Name is Doris was the script that I wrote with Laura Taruso. And even the early drafts of that movie, I was sort of leaning more on the sort of comedic, the absurd, silly part, and was encouraged by my producer Daniela Taplin to kind of go deeper into the more psychological aspects of the character, which felt like something I wanted to do, but I suppose was afraid on some level that I might fail. Like I would go, you know, go into those areas and not know what to do, or, and it turned out, you know, with Doris and then having Sally Field take that role, and kind of the minute Sally Field said, yes, I'll do this part, everything sort of like the whole prism shifted in my brain around, okay, I have this actress, and this actress wants to give an incredible performance, and now my job is to just help her do that in whatever way I possibly can. And it kind of was a game changer for me, I have to say, working with her and seeing the way she worked. And also, she was very much encouraging me to take risks and sort of, you know, giving me pep talks, like, you can do this kind of thing. And I do think that it's like, this is, as a director and as a writer, this is sort of my, where I feel most authentic, is in a kind of, and it's the kind of movies that I love the most, is movies that kind of hit you everywhere. You laugh and you cry and you get to see the full range of human emotion in one sort of 2-hour experience. Well, I'm also a very big fan of theater and plays and musicals. And so my whole life, I've always gone to see as many plays as I can. And there's a kind of a format that you'll see if you go to see a lot of Broadway serious plays, which is that the first 2/3 tend to be very funny. So even in a dramatic play, Tony Kushner or whomever, David Rabe, whatever, the classic American, you know, dramas. I was in a play called, randomly, I was in the original off-Broadway cast of How I Learned to Drive, which ended up winning all these awards.
Oh, not, were you, not you the Teenage anything, Greek Chorus?
Not because of anything I did. Yes, I was the, if you Google it, I'm in the original Broadway cast with Mary Louise Parker and David Morse.
Quite a play.
And it's like the only acting job I've ever really had, for all intents and purposes. But, you know, that couldn't be a more serious play, you know, in terms of the subject matter. But even a show like that is quite funny for the first 2/3. And then it really starts to kind of like go for the knockout punches in the last third of the play. And that's kind of a convention of these of theater. And so I've taken some of that approach, took a little bit of that approach with Doris and a little bit with They Came Together too. I'm sorry, with The Big Sick as well, that you sort of get them laughing for the first 2/3 and then you sort of, you know, you go for your knockout punches in the final third. And that feels very satisfying to me, both as a filmmaker, but then also just as an audience member. Those are the movies that I remember and that really stay with me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you do build that tone really well, and I think that that's probably just because you've had this lifelong love of that genre. So I'm assuming that this is maybe something you want to continue, a vein you want to develop and explore in further films.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I do, but I 100% do. And you know, when I was in growing up, I actually was thinking that I would pursue a career as like a cinema studies professor or something. Both my parents are academics, and that's where I thought my career would go. I never thought that I would be on the production side or an actor or anything like that. And so I just liked movies in general. I liked everything. I liked comedies, and I liked Hitchcock movies and westerns and film noir movies and French movies, and that's sort of what I was thinking I would do. I joined a comedy group my freshman year of college that ended up being my career for still today, which was we were called the New Group then, but it became the State. And then that's where I met David Wayne and Michael Black and all the other guys, and everything kind of turned. But then I actually wound up teaching screenwriting at NYU Graduate Film School, which was a weird sort of everything comes full circle. And that's where I met a lot of the people I'm working with now. And I think in a way, teaching at NYU in the graduate school, where so many of those students are there to make more dramatic films and documentaries, is where I actually, it's the cliche of, you know, they teach me more than I teach them. But in the case of NYU, it really was true. Working with the students really kind of gave me a little bit of courage to practice what I was preaching, because I was helping them to try to get more honest and more down to the essence of the work that they were doing, but I wasn't necessarily doing that in my own writing, in my own work. So there was a symbiosis there.
That's cool. That's good. That's a good way to sort of experience teaching on that side of things, you know, to learn something yourself.
Well, and now they are my collaborators. Laura Taruso, who I wrote Doris with, was not a student of mine, but she was a student at NYU, and that's where I met her. And then I do a TV show called Search Party, and my collaborators on that are Sarah Violet Bliss and Charles Rogers, who were my students.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that show because it's quite something, and it's different than what we're talking about with the film projects, certainly in tone.
Yeah,
but I think it's really quite something. You know, I said something about it when I first watched it that, in a lot of ways, Search Party, with its kind of millennial satire, but also this kind of grimness seeping into the picture, like, I kind of almost feel like it predicted this kind of current political climate, like just the darkness kind of settling on things that once seemed kind of fun.
Interesting.
What has that experience been like working on that show? Because it's, you know, again, it's with younger creators and it's sort of about this very particular sort of generation. What has your experience been, and what do you think you've brought to it for them?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think what you said is interesting, and what I felt about them, Sarah Violet and Charles, who made this movie called Fort Tilden, which won an audience award at South by Southwest some years ago, is that they have a very specific comedic voice that's very different than mine. It's, as you say, it's very dark. Everyone has spikes and armor in their worldview. Everybody is kind of out for themselves. And my point of view is much more kind of hopeful and idealistic, that there's pain and suffering, but that, like, at the deep down, people are really good. Or at least I like to believe that. But growing up, I remember specifically Bret Easton Ellis and the book Less Than Zero, which was sort of like my Catcher in the Rye. And in a way, their work reminded me of that, of this kind of vision of the world as kind of hopeless and selfish and dark, but also very funny. And I felt like it was a really important way in that I hadn't seen, that I felt that I hadn't quite seen. And it reminded me of Less Than Zero or The River's Edge or even, you know, The Graduate or something, of just a certain kind of millennial perspective that is important. So I think what I, because it's not just disaffection, it's not just boredom, it's something darker than that, you know. It's not just, oh, I'm in my 20s and I'm a slacker and I have nothing to do. It's an actual idea that people aren't good. That's actually a little bit of the undercurrent of all of it, is an idea that I think they have, whether they're conscious of it or not, that people actually might not be good, and that people, and that catharsis doesn't happen. People don't change. People don't have a big realization about something and then suddenly they're a different person. It doesn't happen. I don't feel that way. And if I brought anything to this project, aside from just, you know, in a grander sense, I mean, I've been very, actively involved with it, as anyone would be, but just on the larger sense, is to inject some possibility that there's some hope for change. Even if we don't get a chance to see it, I think the audience needs to think that on some level, maybe there's a chance for these characters. If the world is completely hopeless, then I think a certain segment of the audience would tune out. And I think that that would be unfortunate, because they have so much to say. And so there was a little bit of me just trying to broaden the world out to be more inclusive of a wider audience. And that sort of centered around us feeling like these characters, particularly in the Alia Shawkat character, that there's some hope for these characters, that they're not just lost causes.
Yeah, and I think that shines through, and I think it's a really exciting and interesting show. And, you know, I think that that's actually a perfect place to leave it. Michael, thank you so much for talking to us, and congrats on both Search Party and The Big Sick, and my name is Doris, and everything to come. I can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
So that does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Thank you for listening. As always, you can rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate your feedback, and we love hearing from you and on Twitter and on VanityFair.com and all of the ways you can get in touch with us. And please go to VF.com and read our Emmys for Your Consideration series. We've got some really cool interviews and just a great opportunity to talk about the TV that we have loved that we might not have talked about in a few months, but now is a great time to bring it all back up. So you can find us all on Twitter at Little Gold Men, and on our own, I'm at Katie Rich. Richard?
I'm at Rylaws. Mike is Mike _ Hogan. Johanna Desta is at Johanna Desta. Johanna with a Y.
And how about you, Joanna?
I'm at Jo Wrote This.
Hey! This episode was edited and produced by Jordan Bell, and thanks to Andy Bowers at Panoply.
And the award for best sales pitch for readingvf.com goes to Katie Rich.
Oh, this is charming and has young people.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
From PRX.